action. Not long ago, incredible though it may seem, I heard the clerk of an Oxenford store declare that he welcomed the proximity of mass production robot factories and the roar of self-obstructive mechanical traffic because it brought his university into contact with real life. He may have meant that the way men were living and working in the 20th century was increasing in barbarity at an alarming rate, and that the loud demonstration of this in the streets of Oxford might serve as a warning that it is not possible to preserve for long an oasis of sanity in a desert of unreason by mere fences without actual offensive action, practical and intellectual. I fear he did not. In any case, the expression real life in this context seems to fall short of academic standards. The notion that motor cars are more alive than, say, centaurs or dragons is curious. That they are more real than, say, horses is pathetically absurd. How real, how startlingly alive is a factory chimney compared with an elm tree, poor obsolescent thing, in substantial dream of an escapist. I hope our listeners can grasp the sarcasm. For my part, I cannot conceive myself that the roof of the Bletchley train station is more real than the clouds. And as an artifact, I find it less inspiring than the legendary Dome of Heaven. The bridge to Platform 4 is to me less interesting than Bifrost, guarded by Heimdall, which is a reference to the Rainbow Bridge to the abode of the Norse gods in Valhalla. For the wildness of my heart, I cannot exclude the question whether railway engineers, if they had been brought up on more fantasy, might not have done better with all their abundant means than they commonly do. Fairy stories might be, I guess, better masters of arts than the academic person I have referred to. Much that he, I must suppose, and others certainly, would call serious literature is no more than play under a glass roof by the side of a municipal swimming bath. Fairy stories may invent monsters that fly the air or dwell in the deep, but at least they do not try to escape from heaven or the sea. And if we leave aside, for a moment, fantasy, I do not think that the reader or the maker of fairy stories need be ashamed of the escape of archaism, of preferring not dragons, but horses, castles, sailing ships, bows and arrows, not only elves, but knights and kings and priests. For it is all possible for a rational man, after reflection, quite unconnected with fairy story or romance, to arrive at the condemnation implicit in at least the mere silence of escapist literature, of the progressive things like factories or the machine guns and bombs that appear to be their most natural and inevitable, dare we say inexorable, products. The rawness and ugliness of modern European life, and here he quotes from Christopher Dawson in his essay Progress and Religion, the rawness and ugliness of modern European life, that real life whose contact we should welcome, is the sign of a biological inferiority, of an insufficient or false reaction to environment. The maddest castle that ever came out of a giant's bag in a wild Gaelic story is not only much less ugly than a robot factory, it is also, to use a very modern phrase, in a very real sense, a great deal more real. Why should we not escape from the more Lockean horror of factories? A reference to the Morlocks of H.G. Wells' story, The Time Machine. Why should we not escape from the more Lockean horror of factories? They are condemned even by the writers of that most escapist form of all literature, stories of science fiction. These prophets often foretell, and many seem to yearn for, a world like one big glass-roofed railway station. But from them, it is, as a rule, very hard to gather what men in such a world will do. They may abandon the full Victorian panoply with top hat and frock for loose garments with zip fasteners, but will use this freedom mainly, it would appear, in order to play with mechanical toys in the soon cloying game of moving at high speed. To judge by some of these tales, they will still be as lustful, vengeful, and greedy as ever, and the ideals of their idealists hardly reach further than the splendid notion of building more towns of the same sort on other planets. It is indeed an age of improved means to deteriorated ends. It is part of the essential malady of such days, producing the desire to escape not indeed from life, but from our present time and self-made misery, that we are all acutely conscious both of the ugliness of our works and of their evil. So that to us, evil and ugliness seem indissolubly allied. We find it difficult to conceive of evil and beauty together. The fear of the beautiful fae that ran through the elder ages almost eludes our grasp. Even more alarming, goodness in itself, bereft of its proper beauty. In fairy, one can indeed conceive of an ogre who possesses a castle hideous as a nightmare, for the evil of the ogre wills it so. But one cannot conceive of a house built with a good purpose, an inn for hostile travelers, the hall of a virtuous and noble king, that is yet sickeningly ugly. At the present day, it would be rash to hope to see one that was not, unless it was built before our time. This, however, is the modern and special, or accidental, escapist aspect of fairy stories, which they share with romances and other stories out of or about the past. Many stories out of the past have only become escapist in their appeal through surviving from a time when men were, as a rule, delighted with the work of their hands into our time, when many men feel disgust with man-made things. But there are also other and more profound escapisms that have appeared in fairy tale and legend. There are other things more grim and terrible to fly from than the noise, stench, ruthlessness, and extravagance of the internal combustion engine. There are hunger, thirst, poverty, pain, sorrow, injustice, death. And even when men are not facing hard things such as these, there are ancient limitations from which fairy stories offer a sort of escape, and old ambitions and desires touching the very roots of fantasy, to which they offer a kind of satisfaction and consolation. Some are pardonable weaknesses or curiosities, such as the desire to visit, free as fish, the deep sea, or the longing for the noiseless, gracious, economical flight of a bird, that longing which the airplane cheats, except in rare moments, seen high and by the wind, and distance noiseless, turning in the sun, that is precisely when imagined and not used. There are profounder wishes, such as the desire to converse with other living things. On this desire, as ancient as the fall, is largely founded the talking of beasts and creatures in fairy tales, and especially the magical understanding of their proper speech. This is the root, and not the confusion, attributed to the minds of men of the unrecorded past, an alleged absence of the sense of separation of ourselves from beasts. As one critic apparently put it, a vivid sense of that separation is very ancient. but also a sense that it was a severance, a strange fate, and a guilt which lies upon us. Other creatures are like other realms with which man has broken off relations, and now sees only from the outside at a distance, being at war with them, or on the terms of an uneasy armistice. There are a few men who are privileged to travel abroad a little. Others must be content with travelers' tales, even about frogs. And speaking of that rather odd but widespread fairy story, the Frog King, Max Muller, asked in his prim way, "How came such a story ever to be invented? Human beings were, we may hope, at all times sufficiently enlightened to know that a marriage between a frog and the daughter of a queen was absurd. Indeed, we may hope so. For if not, there would be no point in the story at all, depending as it does, essentially, on the sense of absurdity. Folklore origins or guesses about them are here quite beside the point. It is of little avail to consider totemism. For certainly, whatever customs or beliefs about frogs and wells lie behind this story, the frog shape was and is preserved in the fairy story precisely because it was so queer and the marriage so absurd, indeed abominable. Though, of course, in the versions which concern us, the Gaelic, German, English, there is, in fact, no wedding between a princess and a frog. The frog was an enchanted prince. And the point of the story lies not in thinking frogs possible mates, but in the necessity of keeping promises, even those with intolerable consequences. That, together with observing prohibitions, runs through all of fairyland. This is one of the notes of the horns of Elfland, and not a dim note." And there I will leave off, because at this point, our hero, J.R.R. Tolkien, delves into the realm of Christian theology, which does not concern me. But the passage I just read concerns me a great deal, and speaks very much to the mindset, the extremely conflicted mindset that I have been in ever since I saw the Lord of the Rings movie two nights ago. And some of the passages here strike home with an almost brutal power, particularly that which I ended with, about the necessity of keeping promises, even those with intolerable consequences. I suppose if they, the powers that be, want to yank me from the airwaves for keeping the promise that I made to myself and to my comrades that we would use the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade to keep free speech alive, even unto the bitterest hour. Well, as they say in Spanish, ni modo. It's the way it is. Because I am not among those to whom you need say only the land or the radio station you love is doomed to excuse any treachery, indeed to glorify it. I hope never to be among those. The interesting thing about J.R.R. Tolkien is that he was a dyed-in-the-wool conservative, indeed a reactionary. He uses that word here. He uses the word reaction in a favorable sense, and uses the word progressive in a negative sense, if you notice, in the excerpt from this essay I just read on fairy stories, which is, you can read in the book The Tolkien Reader. And yet, the some of the activities which he invokes in defense of what he considers to be reaction and in reaction against what he considers to be progress or progressivism are precisely the activities which our friends in Earth First are and the radical environmental movement are carrying out. If I can find the appropriate passage here again. That it might be necessary to take actual offensive action, practical and intellectual, against the growing ugliness of contemporary life, against the robot age, against the mass production robot factories and the machine guns and bombs that appear to be their most natural and inevitable, dare we say, inexorable products. Tolkien appears to anticipate the kids who put their bodies on the line to defend trees against the builders of roads and factories. Although that movement was still generations away when he wrote these words, or at least a generation away when he wrote these words. So, as much distance as I have from Tolkien intellectually, and as much as I admit to being embarrassed about my recurrent obsession with his works, even in my approaching geezerdom, if I'm no longer a ute, you know, you can sort of, when you're in your teens, I think it's perfectly appropriate to read The Lord of the Rings 5 times in a row, as I did. But I admit to being a tad bit embarrassed about being obsessed with the desire to do so at the age of 40, when our radio station is under siege, and when our government is bombing Afghanistan, and when our constitutional rights are being taken away from us. And yet here we are, and yet there is some subtle connection, between this desire which has seized me to take a little break from the struggle and sit down for a few days with The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. There's a connection between that desire and my commitment to the struggle itself, and that which is preventing me from doing so. My commitment to keep my nose to the grind and not succumb to the temptation more than I have. I've reread a few passages here and there in the name of doing my homework for the radio show. Damn good excuse. I see there's still some people trying to call in, but I don't think we're going for it tonight. I really don't. I urge you all to tune in next week. We'll take phone calls next week. And it is my fervent hope that I will still be on these airwaves next week with my ever-loving co-host, Anne-Marie Hendrickson, to discuss The Lord of the Rings and J.R.R. Tolkien and his life and his works and his contradictions. And to discuss him with and his works with you, the listener, particularly those of you who have read his works or seen the movie. And I urge those of you who haven't seen the movie but have any desire to do so to see it before next week so that we can discuss it over these airwaves. And have some fun. And engage in some escapism without apology and without regrets. Unless, of course, we have been purged from the airwaves, or if some other crisis rears its head once again, which demands our response. Which I hope will not be the case. I wish I could say I trust it will not be the case, but I can only say I hope it will not be the case. No, I'm sorry. That was cut 26, I meant. Cut 26. I'm confused here. Talking to Bob McGill, our trusty engineer, who's getting the next cut lined up for us here. Trusty and long-suffering engineer, I should say, with the completely dysfunctional equipment and dysfunctional co-host who he has to deal with. A reference to my own neuroses. So, I hope this isn't going to be our last show. Just in case it is, a heartfelt thanks to all of our loyal listeners and to all of our comrades in the struggle who have fought for our continued access to these airwaves. And a heartfelt thanks to my co-hosts, Bob and Anne-Marie, for putting up with me and my neuroses. And to you, the listeners, for putting up with me as well. Before we go out with some more medieval music, once again from Songs of Exile, Jewish Musicians in Europe, 1200 to 1600, by the Boston Camerata and Joel Cohen. Well, one question I could pose is whether, one thing I'd like to get to next week is to sort of decode, and sometimes, unfortunately, not much decoding is actually necessary. Some of it is very blatant. But the sometimes quite ugly racial stereotypes in Lord of the Rings. And one question which we might pose is whether the dwarves, with their short stature, bulbous noses, and love of gold and wealth, are indeed based on the European Jews. But we'll save that question for the next show, assuming that there is indeed a next show, and assuming that circumstances allow us to engage in such rife escapism. Meanwhile, one more thing that I would like to read before I go out, before we go out. Just to make the point, I'm going to read, at the moment, I would have to say, this week, J.R.R. Tolkien is my favorite British author. In fact, probably my favorite author. Usually my favorite British author was his contemporary, George Orwell. George Orwell, who probably, I feel quite comfortable saying, never read a single syllable of J.R.R. Tolkien, despite the fact that they were writing in the same era. J.R.R. Tolkien, who was the most hard-bitten realist, who had nothing but contempt for escapism, and who indeed on one occasion, I don't know that he ever actually wrote anything about Tolkien, but on one occasion had some very, very, very deservedly harsh words for Tolkien's good friend and Oxford colleague C.S. Lewis, another writer of fantasy fiction. Nonetheless, there is a passage, and more than one passage, in fact, in Orwell, which mirrors precisely the point that Tolkien was making in what I just read. And obviously, despite the fact that Tolkien was a proud reactionary and Orwell was a socialist and an anarchist sympathizer, at least in his adventures in Spain during the Civil War, obviously there is a shared mistrust of progress and a certain nostalgia for a simpler age when people lived closer to the earth. And I'm going to read a brief verse which Orwell wrote in his youth, which he reprints in an essay entitled Why I Write in 1947, late in his life, looking back on his life's journey and how he strayed from the attitude of his youth. And here's the what he wrote way back in 1935. Here are the words that he wrote, which he later reproduced in the essay Why I Write. A happy vicar I might have been 200 years ago to preach upon eternal doom and watch my walnuts grow. But born, alas, in an evil time, I missed that pleasant haven for the hair has grown on my upper lip, and the clergy are all clean-shaven. And later still, the times were good. We were so easy to please. We rocked our troubled thoughts to sleep on the bosoms of the trees. All ignorant, we dared to own the joys we now dissemble. The green finch on the apple bough could make my enemies tremble. But girls' bellies and apricots now roach in shaded stream. Horses, ducks in flight at dawn, all these are a dream. It is forbidden to dream again. We maim our joys or hide them. Our horses are made of chromium steel, and little fat men shall ride them. I dreamed I dwelt in marble halls and woke to find it true. I wasn't born for an age like this. Was Smith? Was Jones? Were you? Thanks for listening. Join us next week for the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, if in fact we're here. Until then, stay on the front lines. Go see The Lord of the Rings and Salam Aleichem.
Thank you. Malachi McCourt, and this is WBAI Listener Sponsored Radio in New York City.
Wednesday at 9 p.m. You won't want to miss Asia Pacific Forum, the only place you'll hear about grassroots Asian politics, culture, art, and the Asian spirit. Only on WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio.
Many others in a moment's time sacrifice, illuminate light. Many others forgot their own name, but I'm about to use it. Many others.
Asia Pacific Forum every Wednesdays at 9 p.m. only on 99.5 FM.
We choose the same means of here to there, trading our living hours for shelter. Crests and falls like we...
Stay right here. No,
I doubt you'd survive. I said, honey, let's do it.
He lives in a high rise block in the air. Christy McCall from Tropical Brainstorm. You're listening to WBAI New York. This program is Weaponry, and tonight a look at what the next DOD budget for the U.S. Air Force is likely to look like. Pretty much across the board, all of this talk about transforming the military is going to go by the boards, and instead what they're going to do is they're going to add on high-tech stuff rather than replace current force structure with high-tech, the Army's division structure being totally obsolete, for one thing. Ground combat units deploy and operate in brigade, as brigades, not as divisions. But that's not likely to change now that all of the talk of revamping everything has gone by the boards. So I'll have a look at that. Some more info on the Air Force's plans to acquire via lease rather than purchase. Lease for 10 years, which doesn't make any sense because the service life of these aircraft is likely to be 40 years or more. 107 military versions of commercial transport aircraft built by Boeing. They will be, they're buying 4 737s, probably fairly similar, at least in airframe-wise, to the Navy's 737 variant, just entering service now as the C-40. And the bulk of the aircraft, over 100 of them, will be 767 aircraft, almost all configured as aerial refueling tankers. And we'll have a look at unit cost and various other issues. And of course, Airbus is still whimpering that their aircraft wasn't considered, and they're going to bring this up before the World Trade Organization or something like that. But then again, as far as I know, Boeing has yet to manufacture an aircraft where the vertical tail falls off while the aircraft encounters wake turbulence that it should be able to shrug off. And now Airbus is, of course, trying to turn the investigation into how did these stupid pilots manage to do this with our fine airplane? This is, if you look at Airbus accidents over the history of Airbus, you'll find that this is generally their strategy to go after the crew. Even when the fly-by-wire system does something like an uncommanded engine shutdown, it's always the crew's fault. Anyway, so Boeing is going to be providing tanker transport versions of the 767. Of course, the 767 is a very large airplane. Some people wanted to buy the 757, which is smaller and can't use the same maintenance hangars as the KC-135 and KC-10 tankers already in service. The 767 will require major modifications to things like maintenance hangars because you can't get a 767 into a maintenance hangar designed for a KC-135 aircraft, low those 45 years ago when the first C-135 variants began entering service. The average age of an in-service KC-135 airframe right now is 39 years. Some are 5 years older, some are 5 years younger, but they're they've been around a while. And I will have a look at how the air campaign over Afghanistan has affected plans and spending for various Air Force programs. And you know, the Air Force is still hell-bent on retiring one-third of the B-1 heavy bomber fleet, removing some of the B-52 heavy bombers from service, in spite of the fact that they've been doing most of the heavy lifting in the air campaign. And well, future tanker requirements, etc., 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 to paraphrase the King of Siam. If you have any comments or questions or any stuff like that there, offers of large bribes, always well received. You can write to Weaponry, WBAI, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 10005. And and that's here, this location. The New York Military Affairs Symposium will start the 2002 lecture program a week from Friday. That'll be 18 January. And I'll tell you some of the upcoming talks in a couple of minutes. But first, this.
Too thin the line that charged the heights and scrambled in the clay. Too thin the eastern township scoff who showed them all the way. And perhaps had you not fallen, you might be what Brock became. But not one in 10,000 knows your name. To say the name MacDonald, it would bring no bugle call. But the redcoats stayed beside you when they saw the general fall. 'Twas MacDonald raised the banner then and set the heights aflame. But not one in 10,000 knows your name. You brought the field all standing with your courage and your luck. But unknown to most, you're lying there beside old General Brock. So you know what it is to scale the heights and fall just short of fame. And have not one in 10,000 known your name. Now the general on his tower stands alone, and there's lichen on MacDonald carved upon that weathered stone. In a corner of the monument to glory you could claim, but not one in 10,000 knows your name. You brought the field on courage and your luck, but unknown to most, you're lying there beside old General Brock. So you know what it is to scale the heights and fall just short of fame. And now most, you're lying there beside old General Brown. So you know what it is to scale the heights and fall just short of fame, and have not one in 10,000.
Rogers, who in a few months will have left us 20 years ago. It's hard to believe. He was aboard an Air Canada DC-9 with a raging electrical fire under the floor that the crew couldn't get at, and they made a rather amazing emergency landing at an airport in Ohio, Cincinnati, I think. However, when they popped the doors, the superheated air inside the aircraft caused a flashover, and about half of the folks did not get out before the aircraft was totally on fire. It was a he was en route home to Canada from the folk festival at Kerrville, Texas at the time. Anyway, Stan Rogers, who I continue to like a lot. You are listening to Weaponry on WBAI New York Pacifica Radio, serving metropolitan dystopia for well over four decades. Okay, a week from Friday, the New York Military Affairs Symposium lecture series begins with a talk on Operation Brunswick. Could it have ended the war by mid-43? That's a World War II topic. That'll be delivered by Frank Radford of NIMAS. Cliff Rogers of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point will be there a week after that, talking on England's greatest general, Wellington? Montgomery? I'll let you know. February 1st, Lee's lieutenants, the junior officers of the Army of Northern Virginia, Captain Charles Bowery, also from the U.S. Military Academy, West Point, as will be the next speaker, Ethan Rafus, Grant's Overland Campaign in 1864. Bill Castro of Texas Tech University on February 15th will be discussing a famous frigate action outside New York Harbor in 1793. Andrew Buchanan of NIMAS will be speaking on Marx, Engels, and the Civil War. Now, for those of you who don't know the personal details of Karl Marx, he was a war